does not mean that it will suffice for the longer term. Similarly, just because something works once or for one person now does not mean that it iterates well or that it will prove of communal benefit. It is, in fact, the sacrifice of what is best for the medium to long term and the peace of the community to the immediate benefits of the individual and, generally, to the whim of that individual that constitutes the motivation for deceit and the rejection of responsibility. And that is the very definition of immaturity. In stark contrast with this pathologically maintained childishness is the adult sacrifice that is productive work towards the highest conceivable end. Always, the foregoing of immediate gratification, the offering of now to tomorrow, narrow self to future self, and individual to community, is the sacrifice on which the stable psyche and state depend. The alternative, stubborn adherence to a counterproductive highest principle, the Pharaoh's insistence on his absolute sovereignty, for example, reflecting any individual's prideful insistence that his or her subjectivity reigns supreme, will inevitably produce a cascade of always dire consequences. The Pharaoh wants his own way. He elevates his narrowly defined self-interest to the highest place. Consequently, he comes to worship not just himself, but his most immature and impulsive self, a proclivity which all too easily shifts into the demand that everyone else bow down and follow suit. It is this dance that constitutes the eternal dynamic of the hedonist and the tyrant. The hedonist wants nothing but the gratification of desire and must turn to power if he can gain the means to enable that, as no one else remotely sane wants to be reduced to the means of gratifying his desire. The reasons for the dance run deeper yet. Rule of psyche or society by whim means running riot in the present and abandoning responsibility for the future self, for others, and for the future itself. When the partying mounts and becomes unsustainably riotous, either the outside force that represses and restrains will manifest itself, or the flood will rise. Any reality that attempts to orient itself around the narrow, unreliable, and transient axis of whim, whether of citizen or ruler, cannot survive, let alone thrive. Why would the world shift to present what immediate selfish desire requires? What is to be done with the competing demands of every other animate being? What is to become of the future, sacrificed as it will be to the vagaries of the present? Even the sovereign must humble himself in the face of what is truly ultimate, the proper first and last principle or spirit. Authentic power is that which flows from the ultimate source of being and becoming, and woe betide anyone, regardless of earthly prowess, who refuses to recognize that primal fact, which is exactly what the Pharaoh proceeds to do, an increasingly dire 10 times. The second time Moses appears before the Pharaoh, he casts down the staff of his authority. It transforms again into the serpent. The magicians of Egypt duplicate, more concisely, mimic, more truly, parody, the demonstration. But the serpent of Moses' staff devours their lesser snakes. This intimates that the principle of being and becoming, on whose behalf Moses speaks, is the true superordinate principle, even of sovereignty itself. The fakers, psychopaths, and narcissists can imitate the authority of God. In fact, as usurpers, that is their specialty. But in the final analysis, that is nothing but a show at court, the narcissistic attempt to gain false reputation, an empty show signifying nothing. The victory of Moses' staff is part of the process, by which the true source of the productive harmony that should be the foundation of the state makes itself known. God is that to which even the magicians of the most magnificent court must bow, that to which even the commander of those magicians must bow, by definition. It is not at all that the Israelites are insisting, with the fervor of authoritarian believers, that the God they worship must be the one true God. It is that the true followers of Yahweh, those who wrestle with God, are always those seeking to discover what constitutes the genuine, highest, and uniting principle, and then to live in accordance with that revelation. This is very different than the power-mad insistence that a given ideology or principle of power must rule. It is instead submission to the divine order, accompanied by willingness to make the painful, genuine, and personally costly sacrifices that are the eternally valid marker of true belief. This sacrificial behavior is the voluntary subjection of the Israelites to the divine order, their refusal to take to themselves the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, their refusal to consort with or bow down to Luciferian presumption and the temptation to usurp. The legitimate followers of the God of Abraham do not create their own values, as the philosopher Nietzsche insisted so wrongly that we must do in the aftermath of the hypothetical demise of the divine. Quite the contrary. They seek to discover the implicit moral order, signified not least by their tradition, and then to align themselves in harmony with that order. This duty and invitation is their subjugation to God and what frees them from the tyranny and enslavement of even their own selfish desires. Pharaoh maintains his opposition to the requests of Moses and to God himself speaking through the prophet. The rivers of Egypt therefore turn to blood in keeping with the power granted to the Israelite leader. This is the first of the plagues detailed in Exodus 7:12. The main source of the Egyptians' water, the Nile, was central or even sacred to the Egyptians. Its transmutation or pollution is thus a blow struck at the foundation of Egyptian culture. It is also an intimation of worse to come. It is hard to read the appearance of literal rivers of blood as anything other than a dire warning. This occurrence is also a foreshadowing of the utter destruction that takes place later in the Red Sea, another flood of blood. The second plague is one of frogs. The frog is a border dweller living on the edge of the depths. Symbolically, the frog is a psychopomp, a mediator between the divine that harbors itself in the depths and the upper or airy world. In the Brothers Grimm story, The Frog Prince, it is that green amphibian who rescues the golden ball, the sun, the image of perfection, that which rules consciousness, the hero who slays the dragon at night, that disappears when the princess inadvertently drops it into the depths. This is an indication of the alienation of the daughter of the king from that which is most life-giving, necessary, and rejuvenating. It is the frog, a psychopomp, existing on the border between realms, who rescues and restores the divine order. A plague of such frogs indicates nothing less than that the God who is the terrible and eternal judge is about to make himself manifest. Woe betide those who under such conditions have wandered far from the straight and narrow path. The next plagues are of lice and flies. This is the inevitable subjugation of the tyrants to the parasites, the endlessly predictable susceptibility of those who arbitrarily deem themselves highest to invasion by the lowest of the low. when insistence on improper order rules, when true merit is no longer valued, heaven turns to iron, Leviticus 26:19, and the world flips upside down. The ensuing usurpers are always forever precisely those who lead the charge to criticize and question genuine accomplishment and ability. Merit, in a word, always in the name of the hypothetically oppressed, but truly so that their claims to unearned status and privilege may be guised in the cloak of moral purity. If the tyrant did not continually insist falsely that what is of genuine primacy be devalued, his dominance would not remain unquestioned. This forceful insistence increasingly comes to destabilize the judgment and discrimination of individual and state alike, until what is productive and good is deemed usury and deceit, until success is defined as theft, until those who claim victimization at the hands of the meritorious can put forward without resistance their psychopathic, predatory, and parasitical claims. The tyrants tyrannize for their own narrow purposes, but they lay themselves open to waste by the parasites. As this process of invasion unfolds, the unrighteous autocrats become increasingly paranoid, and rightly so. Why rightly? Because those willing to strive under such inverted conditions multiply uncontrollably beyond control in the parasitical manner as they continue their mad rampage through whatever is decent and true. Despite all this mounting calamity, the Pharaoh is stubbornly unwilling to change. This inflexibility is the hallmark of the totalitarian, with his certainty that everything that needs to be known is already known. This is particularly true of the committed ideologues, of those who so self-righteously make the doctrines of men their infallible dogmas, Matthew 15, 8-9, Mark 7, 6-9. A true tyrant resists the correction of error in precise proportion to his prideful certainty. This means that the individuals or the societies that have journeyed the farthest down the path to perdition have to suffer the most torment before they abandon their false worship, forego their pride, and bend a knee in recognition of the insuperable obstacles reality itself is arraying before them. Next, the livestock disappear. This is a partial intimation of the destruction not only of the present, but also of the future, as such animals are literally food, not just now, but for later, and indefinitely later, if they are managed properly. After the demise of the livestock comes the onset of disease in the form of a plague of boils. This is an illness simultaneously painful, disgusting, and shameful, thereby combining the worst of the revenge of the natural and social worlds alike. Devastated, the Pharaoh's magicians find themselves no longer able to duplicate Moses' actions. This is the point when the magic of the false state ceases to operate, when the cracks in the foundation truly begin to show. This is also the transition point between the plagues indicating the collapse of the earthly or material domain, symbolically speaking, and the rebellion of the skies or heavens. First, ashes and dust in the air, bringing with them a disease of the skin, then a plague of lightning, thunder, and hail, then locusts winging their rapacious way forward until everything green vanishes from the earth, then darkness, which means the disappearance of the sun itself, the veritable king of the sky. Disorder now reigns. The earth protests first, then the heavens, until chaos is everywhere. The Pharaoh is compelled to bend a bit. And Pharaoh called unto Moses and said, "Go ye, serve the Lord. Only let your flocks and your herds be stayed. Let your little ones also go with you." Exodus 10:24. Moses, who seems more than a little impatient at this point, refuses, telling the king that even the cattle must be allowed to participate in the divine desert sacrifice. This is, by the way, an indication of the extension of divine grace even to the beasts of the field, an indication of the proper stewardship of the garden and the subduing of the natural order. The Pharaoh rejects the demand and tells Moses that he will be put to death if he ever dare show his face at court again. A final and most terrible plague remains. God tells Moses first to ask the Egyptians for their treasure, and second, that all the firstborn of the land of Egypt shall be put to death, the progeny of beast and king alike. The Egyptians, sufficiently plagued, appear positively happy to comply with the first request. God also tells the Israelites to mark the entryway to their houses, side posts, and lintels with the blood of a perfect lamb, so that God's angel of death will pass over those dwelling places and leave the children residing there intact. God simultaneously informs Moses that the month in which the Passover sacrifice occurs is to be deemed the first month of the year. How is this to be understood? There is a necessary and tight association between the end of one event, time, or epoch, and the beginning of something else, in this case, the movement of the enslaved Israelites to their eventual freedom. It is for such reasons that the sacrificial lamb is roasted and then eaten, accompanied by what is bitter, by people dressed for action. The Israelites eat unleavened bread because there is no time for it to rise. They eat with loins girded, shoes on feet, staff in hand, and in haste. With the dawn of something new, it is always time to act. They are preparing to respond to the call, a requirement that is echoed in Christ's much later warning that he will come like a thief in the night. Watch, therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Matthew 24:42-44. When the call comes, when conscience speaks, it is high time to go, no matter what or when. The wise prepare themselves, so they are always ready. Matthew 25:1-13. The present has already been destroyed by the 9 previous plagues. The death of the firstborn means the eradication of the future, or at least of the best of the future, for the Egyptians. The true tyrant will not quit until both what is and what is yet to be have been destroyed. The sacrifice that eternally protects, the blood of the lamb in this case, is the willingness to offer up everything so that the tyrant can be defeated. It is exactly this requirement that those who claim kingship falsely reject. A healthily dynamic relationship, the kind that constitutes a solid marriage, for example, is the consequence of the myriad of small sacrifices of the narrow wants and wishes of the individual husband and wife to the higher and more inclusive good of the couple and the family. Each small sacrifice keeps the relationship on track, guided by the spirit of meaningful and honest communication. Each bit of honest communication requires at least the small death of some previous commitment or belief, however innocent or guilty. Each bit of honest communication must begin with an attitude of humility. I have something to learn. The willingness to aim at a higher goal. I am committed, body and soul, to the integrity of this marriage. And, most importantly, the willingness to give something up. I am willing to sacrifice whatever reveals itself as an impediment to the furtherance of the relationship. Here are the eternal questions facing each member of a couple aiming at permanent union. Would you rather establish a productive and generous peace or prove yourself right? Would you forgo the delights of victory, in other words, to free your wife or husband from the burden of defeat? This is a particularly relevant question to consider when contemplating the fact that many disputes are likely to arise in the course of a marriage. If you always win, what does that leave for the person with whom you share a household? What are you willing to offer on the narrowly personal side so that the marriage or the family can be strengthened? This may well be a further question in disguise. What would be better for you, all things considered, than even the good thing that you want or value right now? The same principle of wise and mature negotiation applies to the family and the broader community. Continual, incremental self-sacrifice both facilitates opportunities and staves off disaster. The tyrant, by contrast, sticks to his guns regardless of evidence to the contrary. He or she never solves problems when they are small. The snakes inevitably aggregate in consequence of such avoidance, such stubborn refusal, until they lurk underneath everything, and they grow too. When there are enough of them, and when they are large enough, they merge together. Then the dragon of chaos reemerges, ready and willing to devour everything. This is literally the oldest of stories. The death of the firstborn is enough to convince even the Pharaoh that he is powerless before God. The Egyptians load the Israelites with jewels, gold, silver, and clothing, and send them packing. Those who abide by the proper faith will end up with everything, even that which the tyrants have attempted to sequester. Moses tells his departing people, segregated into their familial tribes, that the promised land of milk and honey beckons. This can be profitably read as the better future. As such, every individual in every society is motivated in the positive sense by the vision of improved condition. We are always sojourning from a place that is not yet good enough to a place that is better. That is the very structure of the human journey, the very basis of positive emotion itself. We can flee from what terrifies us, and that is also motivation, but we are eternally attracted by, divinely inspired or made enthusiastic from French enthusiasma, 16th century, and directly from late Latin enthusiasmus, from Greek enthousiasmos, divine inspiration, enthusiasm, produced by certain kinds of music, etc. From enthousiasine, be inspired or possessed by a god, be rapt, be in ecstasy. From entheos, divinely inspired, possessed by a god. From en, in, plus theos, God. The true leader is precisely the person who offers a destination so attractive that his people are motivated to sojourn forward voluntarily, made enthusiastic, that is, God-inspired, by the visionary revelation of possibility and promise. 7.5. The inevitable interregnum of chaos and the guiding spirit. Why is it out of tyranny and into the desert, instead of out of tyranny and into the promised land? The narrative frame outlined in Exodus reflects the archetypal manner in which human frames of perception, attention, and action are transformed. There is, first, the insufficient current state, the tyranny of the present. Then the chaos that makes itself manifest when that state is disrupted. And finally, the aim of the sojourn, the desired future. Between disruption of tyranny and arrival in the promised land, we inevitably traverse the desert. Imagine that you or your family or your community have been existing within a landscape of sterile and outdated preconceptions. Imagine as well that you and yours have been making yourself smaller and less consequential as a result, so that you can all continue to fit, however uncomfortably, within that increasingly restricted dwelling place. People do this to each other all the time, and then perish of the consequential predictability, dullness, and boredom. Imagine then that you decide to let go of all that, to abandon what you believed, or instead, as in the case of the Pharaoh, that you have been forced to do so because everything has collapsed. This does not mean that all the problems you avoided while refusing to confront and change have disappeared. Quite the contrary, they will have instead multiplied in force and number in keeping with the ineluctable iron law of entropy. This means that what replaces the tyranny is chaos, uncertainty and directionlessness, and that is the desert. Anxiety and hopelessness rule in that place. A great leader, a true visionary, can inspire with possibility and bring hope to the journey. Absent that, there is only confusion and strife. Someone under the thumb of a tyrant, even if that tyrant is him or herself, has direction and order, no matter how false and pathological. As soon as that disappears, every direction, or none, beckons simultaneously, and that is too much. That emergent absence of aim and structure is anxiety, because it is too much, and hopelessness, because nothing now beckons to be pursued, asks to be accomplished, or can be productively moved toward. This is not a situation materially better than tyranny. It is merely its dance partner, as intimated previously. It is merely the chaos that is the equally terrible opposite of tyranny. If you have tyrannized and enfeebled yourself and you decide to let that go, your life is unlikely to immediately improve. It may well get worse, however temporarily. The habits that made you a slave have not yet been changed. The consequences of such abdication of responsibility are still likely to remain. This is all in addition to the lack of direction that paralyzes and destroys hope. Why do people refuse so stubbornly to change, even in the presence of overwhelming evidence, even in response to their own pain and suffering? Because a desert interlude inevitably follows a period of subjugation to the tyrant. Because something vital, something that has been worshipped, however falsely, something loved, however pathologically, must be sacrificed with the attendant cost before true freedom can be attained. The eternal clarion call of the man who doubles down on his own misery? Better the tyrant than the desert. The Israelites muster up the faith and courage to depart for the barren wilderness, but they bring with them the habits of dependence and have no idea what to do once on their own. Why? The tyrant exercises power, to be sure, but it does not manifest itself in one dire blow. The would-be authoritarian pushes forward, inch by inch, chipping away. The would-be enslaved retreat in the same manner in unconscionable silence, rendering themselves willfully blind to the evidence of their own cowardice, abdicating the responsibility that would, if properly born, make them noble instead of voluntarily voiceless beasts of burden. This is exactly what happens to Disney's Pinocchio, for example, when he lets the false diagnosis of neurotic victimhood open him up to the blandishments of the delinquents on Pleasure Island. Soon he is reduced to the status of a braying jackass, all in preparation for his service in the salt mines of the tyrants. Generations of such retreat and rejection of responsibility leave their mark. The habits of free men disappear, and the ways of the slave emerge. Moses has offered the promised land itself to his Israelite compatriots and would-be citizens. The destination itself may be clear in the purely practical sense. Moses and his people are set to occupy the land of Canaan, which is not far away geographically. It is very far away, however, spiritually. First, there is nothing paradisal about even the most verdant and productive land if the people who occupy it insist on being self-centered, aimless, and fractious. Those who are careless enough can starve and die in the midst of plenty. Second, the truly slavish and directionless can take forever to get nowhere. Aimless wandering can make any voyage interminable, no matter how brief it might be if undertaken practically. Hence, the otherwise mysterious three generations it takes the Israelites to make a journey that is short in absolute terms. What should guide those who are lost after misadventure? God presents himself to the Israelites as what should properly lead those who are adrift right on the brink of the wilderness, who are standing on the line between the order that has rigidified into tyranny and the chaos of the wasteland, who are trapped between the murderous armies of the totalitarian state and the bloody uncertainty of the Red Sea. How does the divine make itself known in such a circumstance? As a pillar of light in the blackness of the night, and a pillar of darkness, cloud, in the light of day. This is a manner that echoes the eternal interplay between opposites from which the world itself emerges in the Genesis account, a mode of representation with its analog everywhere and in every time. This is the divine that is not least the interplay between calling and conscience, the dance between what beckons to us and leads us forward when things are darkest, and what warns us of the danger and darkness that still threaten when we are in the light and on the straight and narrow path. This is the orienting function of emotion itself that guides us as we make our way into the future, the invitation that is positive emotion itself, hope, longing, excitement, curiosity, the aforementioned enthusiasm, and the caution that is its negative counterpart and independent opposite, terror, grief, and pain. Those who are lost and who cannot find the God who guides have therefore forgotten where to look, at what eternally beckons forward and wisely cautions. This is a fundamental, even instinctual, manner of conceptualizing the source of the meaning that guides us. It is a view remarkably duplicated by the Taoist traditionalists of the Far East, struggling with the same existential problems. Because the pattern of characterization appears identical despite its independent manifestation, this must be regarded at minimum as a profound and telling case of parallel evolution, natural as well as cultural. The spirit of reality itself, for the Taoists, is composed of the eternal interplay of chaos and order, each opposed to the other and each embedded deeply within the other. And this is the reality of experience as such, and not the reductive reality of the material world. The cosmic image of the Taoists is that of two serpents, head to tail, one black, signifying chaos, darkness, confusion, possibility, and the night, the other white, signifying order, light, clarity, actuality, and the day. Embedded into the head of each serpent, however, is a signifier of its opposite. The white serpent has a black eye, and vice versa. This is the eternal interplay between light and darkness, and, more subtly, the eternal emergence of light even in the darkness, and vice versa. An indication or representation of the emergence of the real and meaningful from the realm of potential or possibility in creative concert with the principle, process, or spirit that wrestles with that tohu vabohu and establishes the order that is good. It is in precisely this interplay and emergence that God makes himself manifest to the Israelites at the height of their trouble, when they are most in need of the guidance of the divine. A certain degree of conceptual sophistication is required to understand and represent this dynamic, unsurprisingly, given that it is a representation of reality itself. Order is best comprehended not only as order itself already established, as in the staff of Moses, but as the principle that gives rise to and establishes that order. Chaos, for its part, the serpent in the staff, must likewise be considered in its dual element, as potential or possibility itself, as well as the spirit that challenges, nurtures, renews, or usurps. What else might be understood about the eternal play of yin and yang? That the rug can be pulled out at any time, that beneficial and stable order can transform itself suddenly, accidentally, or as a consequence of willful blindness, into utter chaos and catastrophe. There is a certain arbitrariness and randomness about existence, of course, which is simply a fact of potential and possibility. But the role of the conscious choice of men and women in the emergence of chaos should never be underestimated or downplayed. Such a collapse is often precipitated directly or indirectly by the sins of men, as we have seen, whether these are the prideful presumptions of Adam and Eve, the failure to offer properly, and descent into bitterness characteristic of Cain and his descendants, the disloyalty of Ham, or the false celebrations and aims of the engineers of Babel. On the positive side, however, it is the case that a new order can realize itself in the midst of even extreme confusion and uncertainty, such that everything previously established is restored and something additional added. This is the nature of the progress that occurs as a result of the interplay of yin and yang, the continued upward spiral around the trunk of the tree of life, up Jacob's ladder, toward the ever-receding heights of heaven itself. It is the eternal dynamic of order and chaos that makes the world. This is the interplay between what you have come to understand and what you do not yet and may never understand. This is the incomprehensible union of the territory you have mastered and the territory you have still to encounter and explore, or what you have presently conceptualized and what remains beyond understanding for now. And even what you have mastered and conceptualized can and does dissolve into the unknown when things fall apart around you. This is the Taoist and the biblical world simultaneously, and it is an accurate representation of the reality that has in truth shaped our adaptation, even when considered in the purely biological and evolutionary sense. The fact of a reality structured in this manner is reflected neurologically, not least, which is an indication as profound as any of its truth. Delving into this fact helps establish the validity of the symbolic representations under consideration, providing them with a physical analog or foundation, as opposed to their descent from on high, so to speak. The brain's left hemisphere is not specialized for the linguistic and the right for the nonverbal, as is commonly held, but for operation in the known and unknown, respectively, with the linguistic, non-linguistic division of labor, a subset of that more fundamental distinction. This implies very strongly, even from the bottom-up materialist perspective, insofar as that is reflected in the consequences of natural selection, that the cosmos is, in fact, as well as metaphor, the unknown and foreign, as such, in a musical dance with the known and familiar. This, in turn, implies something even more fundamental, that meaning is not a mere epiphenomenon, a transient and mutable subjective overlay on an intrinsically senseless material substrate, but a manifestation of what is most real, instinctively and actually, insofar as what is real and actual, is reflected in the organization of the highest reaches of our nervous systems. Our very physiology bears the implicit and indwelling image of the world, as well as our psyches or souls. We are veritable microcosms reflecting not only the deepest order of things, but also the order of the spirit of things itself. The atheist evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins himself has made precisely this case, stating explicitly not only that, quote, a living organism is a model of the world in which it lives, end quote, but is also all of the following. But I began by saying, not that an animal's brain contains a simulated model of its world, but that an animal is a model of its world. What is the sense of such a statement? One way to approach it is to realize that a good zoologist, presented with an animal and allowed to examine and dissect its body in sufficient detail, should be able to reconstruct almost everything about the world in which the animal lived. To be more precise, she would be reconstructing the worlds in which the animal's ancestors lived. That claim, of course, rests upon the Darwinian assumption that animal bodies are largely shaped by natural selection. The zoology of the future will perfect techniques of combining sources of information and analyzing their interactions, resulting in inferences of enormous power. The computer, incorporating everything that is known about the body of the strange animal, will construct a model of the animal's world to rival any model of the Earth's weather. This, it seems to me, is tantamount to saying that the animal, any animal, is a model of its own world, or the world of its ancestors. If all that is true, how can the instinct that compels and guides development, the intuition of meaningful structure and of meaningful advance, be anything other than a true reflection of the structure of being and becoming itself, be anything less than the image of God in man and woman alike? In the world of existential apprehension, in the world of experience itself, and how, even in principle, can there be a more fundamental reality? It is eternally meaning first and matter later. And that is the very world of perception, despite all contrary protestations of the empiricists. There are a vast multitude of facts, a chaotic plethora of facts, an incomprehensible plenitude of facts, Consciousness lends value to that chaos, subdues it, puts everything in its proper place, and forever establishes the order that is good. In keeping with such a conceptualization, Dawkins also notes the following. We could say that the nervous system uses short economical words for messages that occur frequently and are expected, long, less economical words for messages that occur rarely and are not expected. That efficiency is a crucial part of the ordering process, part of the manner in which our linguistic ability establishes the fundamental traditions and assumptions of its patterns of representation. What makes itself manifest as self-evident across time becomes coded ever more deeply, efficiently, and immutably. This is the very staff of tradition, the staff which springs to life when planted in the ground, the staff around which the serpent that changes and varies eternally twines itself. The same thing appears true of the genetic code itself, which may mutate randomly, but which conserves what is fundamental and vital in spite of that randomness, repairing what is crucial with 100% accuracy when it is damaged by the process that drives mutation while allowing necessary experimentation on the fringe. The importance of this relatively recent discovery can hardly be overstated, as it changes the very way we understand the development of life, the conservation of what is crucial, and the variation that allows for vital change, and is something whose discussion we will therefore return to. Dawkins, additionally, and in the same vein, points out that we can simulate the future, abstracting from past regularities, and that we do this in stories using imagination. Thus, the structure of reality is, according to the evolutionary biologist and atheist, mirrored in imagination and presented in narrative form. Why would this dictum somehow not apply to the very stories on which the entirety of Western civilization is predicated? More from the same source. Natural selection built in the capacity to simulate the world as it is, because this was necessary to perceive the world. Dawkins' closing remarks? And once natural selection had built brains capable of simulating slight departures from reality into the imagined future, a further emergent capacity automatically flowered. Now it was but another short step to the wilder reaches of imagination revealed in dreams and in art, an escape from mundane reality that has no obvious limits. Perhaps not an escape, Dr. Dawkins, as adaptation itself is what is being portrayed and described. Perhaps instead, a voyage precisely paralleling that of Abraham, following the call of the spirit of adventure, or of Jacob climbing the ladder heavenward, or of Moses peering into the ultimate depths of reality. Not an escape at all, except when immature or pathological. Instead, a use of the power of imagination, use of drama, use of abstraction into the transcendent realities of fiction, allowing a simulation superseding anything, mere so-called and impossible in any case, direct perception, might be capable of managing. Are abstractions more or less real than the data from which they are abstracted? What about mathematics, sir, or the eternal world of the Platonic forms, or the vital, necessary, and irreplaceable fact of the functional ideal that is a necessary prerequisite or precondition for all perception of, quote, empirical sense data, end quote. By the same logic, the fact that the psychological and underlying physiological structure of a human being is that of a personality, essentially a hierarchy of attentional and action prioritization, each bearing a particular character, implies that the environment to which that personality is adapted, more accurately, of which it is a model, is in some real sense also a personality. It might be objected, this cannot possibly be true of the purely material world, even if it is true of the aggregate social world to which each person is necessarily adapted and after which each is modeled. This would be adaptation to society as if it were a person with whom a relationship must be established. This may be true, which would mean that the spirit of the biblical corpus and, more broadly, of the mythological realm is nothing but the reflection of the realm of human interaction, past and present. However, given that the social realm is itself necessarily an adaptation to and therefore a model of the underlying material world, that is not much of a reduction, and definitely not one that fundamentally dispenses with the deeper issue at hand. Why would we presume that the spirit giving rise to being and becoming itself is something dead, unconscious, pointless, and lacking identity, when adaptation to that reality has required consciousness, teleology and purpose, and personality? Is it merely chance, or even the arbitrary requirements of human society, that has organized the world such that some patterns of moral striving further life, individual and communal, and others do not? Or is that instead not and inevitably a reflection of the deepest of underlying realities? If the concept of God as personality works, so to speak, in the time-tested manner, in the pragmatic manner, why is that model not aptly regarded as most accurate? This is all keeping in mind the fact that the God of the biblical corpus is, as is constantly insisted on in the text and the tradition, ineffable, and finally, incomprehensible, outside even of nature, even of time and space. Exodus 3:14, Job 38-41, Isaiah 55:8-9. This is why even the greatest of prophets, Moses himself, can see no more of God than his back in passing. Exodus 33:17-23. This fundamental mystery of the divine does not mitigate comprehensively against the possibility of characterization, else adaptation itself, as well as comprehension, would be impossible. Instead, what seems to be true is something very much akin to, or even identical with, the axiomatic Judeo-Christian assumption and the subsequent and derivative scientific insistence that the cosmic order is characterized by its logos, its intelligibility, and that the human mind and soul can and should investigate, comprehend, and ally itself with that intrinsic order. It is also the case that the future can be negotiated with through sacrifice, and that the proper sacrifices, generally of the narrow to the broad and the present to the future, can ensure abundance, security, and opportunity in that very future. Reality is thus best conceptualized as something that human beings exist in relationship with or to, and it can be and should be conceptualized akin to or like a personality. We are characterized in the biblical texts as images of God. This implies or indicates that whatever God is greater than a mere human personality, but is something that is at least sufficiently similar so that the idea that we are reflections of the divine nature is valid. Thus, the personality of God. The fact of such representation or conceptualization can, once again, be attributed to the human attempt to characterize the meta-spirit of humanity itself, the necessity to represent the existential requirement to negotiate honestly and productively with other people, the necessity to represent the consequences of such negotiation when successful or failed. Such attribution, to say it again, does not solve the problem. The very humanity in question emerged out of the dust of the world, so to speak. It therefore seems reasonable to assume that this very dust had in its implicit structure and organization the pattern eventually reflected in the social world. Why is there such great insistence on the fact that reality itself is dead and blind in some final sense when the organisms that inhabit it live and see? Is this not more likely a consequence of our ignorance with regard to the final nature of the material rather than a limitation placed on the nature of being by that material? It is not as if we understand what the world is made of materially in any scientific and simple reductionist sense. The dust out of which we all emerge is unimaginable in its central aspect. The mysteries of the quantum world have assured us of that. Whatever is at the bottom of things appears no less incomprehensible than any spirit, hypothetical or otherwise, that might characterize the cosmos. And perhaps our reductive materialism is a reflection of something worse than mere ignorance. Maybe we insist on the deadness and intrinsic meaninglessness of the world to rationalize our unwillingness to accept the immense burden of opportunity and obligation that a true understanding of our place in a truly meaningful world would necessitate. Perhaps it is not religion that is the opiate of the masses. Perhaps it is instead that a rationalist materialist atheism is the camouflage of the irresponsible. Let us return to the immediacies of the story at hand. We left the Israelites just as they had made off with the treasures abandoned by the morally inverted and careless Egyptians on the knife edge of their next adventure, suspended between the rigid stone tyranny of the Pharaoh and their disoriented but upward-aiming desert wandering. They had determined to risk the adventure of journey to the promised land under the guidance of Moses, proximally, and God, distally, and with all their belongings, livestock, and families intact, despite the Pharaoh's initial forbidding of exactly that departure. Perhaps they feel that the worst is behind them. But the reality of yesterday and habit is a tricky thing to contend with, as the American novelist William Faulkner so famously indicated. The past is never dead. It's not even past. The desperate king of Egypt, humiliated by his sequential defeats, angry at the loss of his indentured servants, and grief-stricken by the death of his son, vows to pursue the children of Israel, Exodus 14:8, and arranges the full might of his army, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, to do so. The Israelites catch word of this. Terrified, they begin to doubt the wisdom of their movement forward. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. And they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Exodus 14, 10 to 12. Moses upbraids his timorous followers, calling on them to have faith in the spirit that drove them out of the hands of their oppressors. The pillar of light or darkness leading the chosen people shifts position so that it is now an obstacle to the approaching Egyptians. It is at this point that Moses expands his mastery of the water. And the Lord said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Exodus 14, 26 to 29. The Israelites find themselves between the proverbial rock and hard place, the Red Sea that confronts them, and equally the Egyptians, is the eternal flood of blood, confusion, and bedlam engendered by the worst of the tyrannical states. There is no going back, however. The very armies of the Egyptian state have arrayed themselves in a manner that precludes retreat. There is only the decision to wayfind through the blood, uncertainty, and possibility that is the crimson chaos itself, the dreadful and potentially deadly intermediary between stone and desert. Moses is he who finds firm ground, step by careful step, guided as he is, as all the Israelites are at this time, by the very instinct that orients us in the face of life's uncertainties. His discovery of a pathway through is what we all seek whenever we encounter the unknown after leaving the zone of comfort, familiarity, and security, however false and tyrannical that may have been. We perceive not the dead and meaningless material objects of the world in their endless multiplicity, but the way forward. If our aim is true, the pathway is cleared for us precisely by the Spirit of the Highest, as our perceptions, patterns of attention, and actions are specified by our aims. The spirit we most truly call upon is inevitably the spirit that emerges to guide us. This is true technically as well as metaphysically. Perception itself is motivated. The true leader calls upon the eternal spirit of being and becoming to specify the destination. The pathway through the waters that would otherwise destroy us thereby makes itself known. Firm ground appears magically beneath our feet as we walk forward courageously and in good faith, eyes heavenward, toward the promised and proper destination. Those who are, by contrast, possessed by the spirit of their own machinations will find themselves flooded, drowned, and destroyed. Afterward, Moses demonstrates yet again his mastery of the chaotic element, as well as his ability to rule over tyranny. The Israelites stop next at a well in Marah after 3 days without water, but the well proves to be bitter. God shows his prophet a tree which he casts into the water, removing the bitterness. What does this mean? That the succor offered by the leader chosen by God provides the water that is forever sweet. The Gospel of John 4:10 similarly recounts the tale of Christ meeting a Samaritan or foreign woman by a well. She asks him to procure for her a drink. Jesus answered and said unto her, "If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water." Likewise, but more extensively, Revelation 21:5-6, announcing a new heaven and a new earth, that is, the recreation of the cosmic order. And the one seated on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are faithful and true." And he told me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give freely from the spring of the water of life." The water provided by those who abide by the dictates of the God of Abraham and Isaac is the water that is eternally granted to and fulfills those who thirst after righteousness, Matthew 5:6. The voluntarily self-sacrificing individual on whose offering the community, the stability of the present and the promise of the future is most truly based is also the source of the water that does not end and that flows even in the desert. This is a meta-water, a reflection of the ethical process or mode of being by which the liquid that nourishes both concretely and spiritually is forever wrested from the intransigent material matrix. It is better to dig a well than to drink. It is better to know how to cooperate and compete productively and generously than to dig a well. It is even better yet to aim up and tell the truth than it is to plan to cooperate and compete productively and generously, not least because planning requires for its success a concrete and defined outcome, rather than the higher faith that love and honest conduct will bring about what is best, regardless of evident consequence. 2.5 months into the desert, the Israelites once again lose faith and carp, protest, and grumble in a manner both derisive and resentful. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Exodus 16:2-3. Sad, but they did have the habits of slaves. The sloughing off of responsibility is part of voluntary slavishness, a veritable prerequisite to domination by tyranny. This means to abandon the duty to reflect the image of God, to confront chaos and pathological order, and to forego the adventure and the meaning that sustains through crisis. The cost of failure to shoulder the cross, so to speak, is sacrifice of the relationship with what is truly highest and consequent weakness in the face of the crises of life. God tells Moses that he will provide manna from heaven and flesh from the earth. Thus, the Israelites are provided with both spiritual nourishment, the bread from above, and material in the form of the quails that gather around the camp in the evening. This is an indication in imaginative terms of the fact that provision in the wasteland is dependent both on what matters, that is the heavenly pattern of meaning, and on matter itself, that is the abundance of the earth in the most concrete sense. The Israelites are instructed not to gather more sustenance than is necessary for the day, but to trust entirely in God as they make their way through the desert. This is a precursor or variant of the later gospel injunction. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for the morrow shall take thought about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Matthew 6:34. God tells the Israelites at the same time to make a container and to place some of the manna within it so that it can be retained for the observation and consideration of later generations. Exodus 16:32. This is a poetic indication that society itself is required for its maintenance to remember the spiritual food that nourished it, to gather it up, to preserve it and pass it down, to place it in a treasure box so that everyone knows and is reminded of its existence, so that tradition itself becomes the storehouse of the eternally nourishing value that descends from heaven. It is at this point that we are informed that the Israelites are destined to wander for 40 years, for three generations, feeding on manna and quail before they enter the promised land. Exodus 16:35. Does it take that long to shed the habits of slaves? A transformation that comprehensive could easily be a multi-generational venture. And another mystery, the land itself, Canaan, is inhabited. This raises the question, would a just and merciful God offer a land already occupied to a new people? The answer, perhaps, is this. Those who organize themselves psychologically and communally into a hierarchy of properly divine order will inevitably and finally triumph over those who do not. The Canaanites, it should be remembered, are the descendants of Cain, the resentful people, bitter worshippers of false idols, hedonistic and mad for power. The delivery of Canaan to those who truly wrestle with God is the inevitable and promised triumph of those who adopt the adventurous path and make the proper sacrifices that constitute genuine maturity, orientation to the future, and productive social being. When the Israelites run short of water, they look back yet again towards Sodom, as it were, pining for the niceties of the Egyptian tyranny and adding to that hypocrisy another litany of complaints. God tells Moses to strike the rock of Horeb with his staff, which he does, and water flows from it. This is a callback, and in a few dimensions. Moses previously overcame the rigid stone kingdom of Egypt with his staff of transformation, both tree of life and serpent. Now in the desert, he does the same under different conditions, calling forth what is necessary for life from the barren and lifeless elements. This narrative note also serves to bolster his identity and status as master of eternal water. Horeb is also Sinai, as indicated previously, the holy mountain connecting earth to heaven, the Axis Mundi, around which all conceptions and the whole world rotates. The staff of tradition that anchors and establishes, the center of all the order that is good or very good. It is always where heaven reaches down to kiss the earth that the water that quenches all thirst springs forth. This is exactly what happens when calling makes itself known, when a new revelation is realized, and when something truly meaningful occurs. That is all a manifestation, materially speaking, of the instinct calling us all to transform upward and develop in the manner that is the genuine, redeeming adventure of life. Shortly thereafter, the Israelites face a major threat. The Amalekites, a passing nomadic tribe, attack. Moses climbs a nearby hill and brandishes the magic staff of his divine authority, the magic wand of Gandalf and Dumbledore, the shepherd's crook of David, the lightsaber of Obi-Wan Kenobi, the spear of Odin that never misses the center of the target, the flag that rallies the troops, the branch that makes the bitter water sweet, the tree of life itself. As long as the prophet holds the staff aloft, the Israelites prevail. This reflects the necessity of the center as uniting and motivating standard, particularly to those in crisis. This is the Platonic ideal that gives necessary and heavenly form, even in the midst of the crimson chaos. When Moses tires,